When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Now, as you know, we are doing another live show. Cambridge Audio presents Rockonteurs Live.
We are delighted to say Trevor Horn is joining us for a special show in London on November the 2nd, and we have some extra tickets to ensure you can join us.
So these extra tickets will only be available to subscribers of Rockonteurs and are on a first-come basis. So if you subscribe, make sure you get your tickets now.
And if you haven't signed up yet, just go to rockonteurs.com to find out more and get your free tickets.
Rockonteurs subscribers will get access to our upcoming live events, bonus episodes, meet and greets, exclusive Q&As and much more. Find out more at rockonteurs.com.
Obviously not when this goes out, but I should point out today one should be wishing you a very, very happy birthday.
Thank you so much. I have finally accepted that I can only play parts down to 41.
But you're still not using your free London Transport Pass, are you?
I refuse to do that. But I suppose the other good thing is I'm now almost the title of a Beatles song.
Oh, well, there is that. There's always that. And but also, by the way, this is a great day for Rockonteurs. Again, this is all in the past, but it's quite nice to mention because our Davy Johnson episode has just gone out and it's gone in at number one. And one of the stories Davy told us about Elton trying to push a piano off the stage because he was drunk has made it onto the Today Show on Radio 4, The Times and The Telegraph.
Yeah, isn't that good, right? And I know this, our next guest, who's been on the show before, but has this amazing book out. He's got a big birthday coming up this month too. He's going to be 60.
Johnny, 60. Yeah.
60. Little Johnny Marr is going to be 60. I mean, it's hard to fathom, isn't it, that we're all at that age now.
Yeah, and he's probably going to get a guitar for every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this book, it must be said, this book is, it's. I haven't seen a guitar book like it. It's beautiful.
I love it. Mars Guitars. The trouble is, this is going to be the most expensive book I never paid for. because it's inspiration. It's going to have me walking up and down Denmark Street and various other guitar shops over how you know the next years of my life. I should buy a birthday present for myself, shouldn't I?
Well, you should. Yes, you should. Because I'm
and 1950.
Actually, I have got you one. I've got you a lovely present.
We have to meet. 1959, of course, is a great year for any guitar. So
it's a great year for one in particular, isn't it?
Well, one in particular, but I don't think I'm allowed to buy that.
No, you can basically buy a Les Paul or a house.
Or a divorce lawyer.
Anyway, it's fantastic that we're going to be seeing Johnny. He's a proper dear old friend of the Rockonteurs, and we love him and we know you do. So let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
John!
All right.
Hello, mate.
Look at that northern sunshine.
I know, I'm trying to avoid it. I've got blinds down and everything, trying to avoid all this sunlight.
Your studio looks beautiful. It's just full 80s video, isn't it? With the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like Mr.
Oh, yeah.
Or something.
No, it's Richard Gere, American Gigolo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sold more blinds than any other film ever.
One tries. Gary, one tries.
Your studio looks beautiful. I've got so much studio envy as I'm looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the room that I've got in my house. It's kind of, it's turned into a bit of a mixing room. I got it. I did this really because technology got so small. The story is, I used to have a big, I had a studio at my previous place, and it was in a separate building, like an outbuilding, kind of like a barn, big live room and everything. Really beautiful place. And then when we moved, I moved into this industrial kind of space at the top of an old mill outside of Manchester. That's my real studio. But the point is, I spent a few years running around telling everybody, probably Guy, that I've seen the light. I've seen the light. Don't have a studio in your house. Don't. After 20 odd years, I've seen the light. Drive to the studio. Anyway, now I've got two. I've got one at home and I've got one somewhere else as well.
And where do you go? Where do you put, what's your go-to?
I try and usually if I'm, you know, my normal, you know, Sibby life, I go to the studio, my studio every day. It's about 20 minutes down the road. And it's in this big, as I say, this big industrial space. You have to come and see it sometime. And it's on the top floor of an old factory. Because of that, I think you'll know what I'm talking about, you guys. The very first thing I did when I moved in there was I just got these kind of Human League Cabaret Voltaire vibes. The very first song I did in there was I got a drum machine and put it through some pedals, this song called New Dominions. Mm-hmm. And you know, this sort of, I have this associative northern industrial kind of place, sort of vibe about it, which I like and which has really worked, but it's all windows. It looks a little bit like a New York loft in the 70s or 60s. It's brilliant. Suffice it to say, I'd just never be able to do that in London because space and the money, you know.
I was going to say, I've got a space right near Knowles, actually, and most of my guitars now have all moved over to there.
Yeah.
And so my little place at home is, which is really nothing but a box room, but I can make good sounding tracks on it. It's just got one or two guitars sitting in it now. I'm always wondering, where should my guitars live, you know? And that's, I'm asking you that question.
I like that idea. I like that idea, but just having a few go-tos. And I think with technology really being what it is these days with online line-in stuff, Kempers and Fractals and the new Fender thing, and, you know, you can get so much tonal variety now. You really can cover a lot of bases with just a few guitars. So I like that idea of, you know, sparsity and, like, you know, getting lean. I do like that, says the guy.
You like you say that, Johnny. I was going to say, I think you like the idea of it.
Says the
but
guy
I
who's
think
just
y- your reality book. Is exactly
132 guitars not out.
One of the reasons why I found myself being drawn to doing this book was kind of along those lines anyway. It was a sort of reappraisal. There was a few reasons why I've done the book. But
first can we just say it's the most beautiful guitar book ever. It's so fantastically photographed, and your stories.
Thank you, Guy. Yeah.
But obviously, it's all about the blonde Rickenbacker 12 string in the middle. That
looks good, though.
Does look very, very good.
What's the story?
Johnny came down and played on something for me for the Transit Kings album, actually, the thing I was doing with Don Beacon and at my studio, because Johnny happened to be in the townhouse. And he said, oh, can I play this? And he played this Ricky 12, came up with a brilliant part as ever. And then a week or two later, I get a call from Johnny. I go, oh, you know that Ricky? Yeah. Do you want to sell it? I didn't really, but it's Johnny. What are you going to do?
Sweet.
I've never had one since. I've never had another Ricky 12.
I really enjoyed doing that part, that Transit Kings thing.
It's a great part. Such a good part. Yeah.
Do you get mentioned in the book for that guy?
He does at the back. I got mentioned. You do?
Oh, do I?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know what?
I didn't see all that.
Yeah. He's...
Sorry.
Come on, guy. Due diligence.
No. Yeah. I mean, listen, Johnny, I was saying on the introduction, I love this book so much, but it's going to be the most expensive book that I ever got for nothing, because it's going to just cost me. It's inspiring me to go out shopping. This is just an envious collection of guitars. What's so beautiful is how you're not like most guitarists, and I have to say who latch on to one type of guitar. And, you know, actually Clapton's has a wide taste, and so did Harrison. But, you know, a lot of guitarists just latch on to one type of guitar, and that becomes their signature guitar forever. It took you a long time to get to that signature guitar, didn't it?
Yeah. The thing with me is if I make, you know, the parallels really, I say Jimmy Page, for example, you know, when when one thinks of Jimmy Page, most people think of him with a Les Paul, but musicians, particularly people who are really students of the guitar, they know that one of the aspects of Jimmy Page was that he used harmony 12 strings or different acoustic 12 strings, and he used B string bender, and he used Telecaster, and he used 335 and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And another one, I guess, is Pete, you know, Pete Townsend. We're all like people who we use different guitars to do different jobs, but still manage to be associated with a guitar, I think.
But your diversity has been extraordinary, and it's been really your journey through music, hasn't it, that diversity?
Yeah, well, that happened in the making of the book, really, Gary. That journey thing and the telling of those stories was genuinely something that I hadn't actually planned. What really with the impetus for the book was that my friend Pat Graham is a real genius photographer. He specializes in, he's very artistic, Pat, and he specializes in taking these macro, really detailed photographs of bits of things, and it blows them up. And then they're these really beautiful, abstract, artistic photographs. So if you give him your guitar and ask him to take a photograph of it, what comes back is this abstract, amazing kind of photograph. And you go, is that like some sunset in Iceland or something? Yeah, and he goes, oh no, I saw this beautiful bit of rust on the case. And then I took this photograph and I blew it right up. And you're like, amazing, beautiful photos. So seriously, first off, a few years ago, I thought I'd love to produce a book like that, an art book or coffee table book, if you will, of these really artistic, fantastic photographs, and use my guitar as the source material or my guitar collection. And that was the idea. So usually with guitar books, as you guys will know, usually guitar books look like watch catalogs.
Auction catalogs, that's all they are.
The photographs are in these dark rooms with sexy James Bond type lighting. And the idea is really to make the objects look five times more expensive than they are. You know, they look like Rolex adverts or something. And they're really quite boring. And you're supposed to see the whole thing, make these portraits. Well, I came at it from the opposite way. I wanted a coffee table book, art book, also for people who, I had this whole thing about people who wouldn't normally buy guitar books or think they want guitar books to have it. I found that, I don't know whether you guys know this, but I found that as I've got older with making records and a couple of other projects that I've done, one was the autobiography, that the creative process, you have considerations that I find this very interesting. When I was younger, making an album with whoever, I used to think the more considerations, the better, and that kind of worked for me. So you can have one consideration might be the album's got to be different to the last time. The other consideration might be we've got a concept. Another one is we want to please the press, blah, blah, blah. I used to think all of these spinning plates were useful, and that's the way I used to do things. But as I've got older, I've realized that if you've got four or five strong considerations that are really, you feel good about, I've done this with records, just apply those or adhere to those. And that happened with the book. For example, I had this notion that I remembered being a kid where most of my more middle-class friends, I come from a working-class background, they would have coffee table books, whereas we didn't, just didn't bother. And there was the Book of Mercedes or Book of British Gardens or Zen Gardens or Book of Architecture. We didn't have those in my house. We had records, right? So I thought, well, one of the considerations with this was, as I was in the process early in, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if this book was good enough to be the go-to guitar book because it's so beautiful and because it looks like an art book? So when I went to the publishers and we were working this thing out, that was a big consideration of mine. Like, I want this to be for people who, it's just so beautiful that people who wouldn't ordinarily think about having guitar books would have them, like they have the Porsche book or the Zen Gardens book.
But also, like the close-ups that he does of the grain and the patina that's cracking almost looks like landscape topography, you know, and that history that's contained in that close-up is what really turned me on in this book. You know, I don't kind of go for new guitars, and you know, I love that look of something that's got some history in it that even goes earlier than me. You know, I've got guitars older than me, so have you. You know,
yeah.
That's how this book starts to look almost physiologically at the guitar, which I found very beautiful.
Yeah, no, because they're kind of not just guitars, also because they all have these wonderful, wonderful stories. Because there's the other thing that comes out, Johnny, is A, how incredibly generous you are, right? I mean, all these guitars have been on this album, that one, I lent this one to so-and-so, and then so-and-so had this one. Also, yeah. What's amazing is how few guitars people go to work with. It seems extraordinary. You're lending Radiohead guitars because they don't seem to really have any.
I know. You do, all of the Rainbow album.
In Rainbows,
doing,
yeah.
In Rainbows, they've got no guitars in the studio and they have to call you up.
Why?
Is that what happened?
What are they, poor? I mean,
well, I think, well, I got in there early with this idea of, I just kind of grew up with this idea of the guitar arsenal, if you like, because the records I used to listen to and really love, they had very loud acoustics on, so, for example. That was an unusual thing about the Smiths records I later found out. Although at the time, I think I was, you know, I knew when I was pushing it. You know,
it's lovely the way you talk about that in here, by the way, the way you talk about your use of acoustics. It's really enlightening. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, so it was a bit of, thank you. It was a bit of, with regard, I didn't amass or collect guitars because I wanted a huge guitar collection. It was all just as I went along, was able to afford it. Oh, okay, that 50s thing, I'll put that 50s sound on the record. So Queen is Dead's got some of that on it, or the 335 12 strings that I use. I ended up using, like with Talking Heads, and quite extensively on the last Smiths record. Bernard Butler's got that now. So they were all, as soon as I got one, I would put it to some use, and it became this, well, you know, what I ended up calling the guitar orchestra that I was very proud to have. But then it just kind of grew and grew. So I think maybe with a band like Radiohead and quite a few bands as well, I think they get attached to the instruments that they start out with, and they, you know, and they go from album to album. But with some bands, it just doesn't occur to them that actually, you know, an SG, a 60s SG will make you play quite differently. And I think that's what happened with, from what Ed tells me with Radiohead, I think Tom ended up using my SG quite a lot. And I know Ed used the Les Paul, but because you have these no-nos as well. I mean, we know about these things. It's very important when you start out, they like, thou shalt not ever play, thou shalt not be seen wearing, you know. Yeah.
Well, because I want to pull you up on this, Johnny, because I remember, because it was in the 90s you started getting SGs, right? When they came back. And in the 80s, you had a thing, you would not play them.
No,
you would not play an SG. You wouldn't be seeing it. And I remember Kirsty McCall bought an SG and she said to you, Johnny, I don't know if this is any good. Will you have a look at it for me? Check it out. And you just went, sorry, can't do it.
But I think when you're young, those things are actually valid.
Of course, it's so important. Absolutely.
But because for me, you know, there's all these associations. I talk about all these things in the book, really, hopefully people who aren't guitar nerds or guitar players, they don't know these things and it's news to them. So to get back to this consideration thing, another consideration I had was for people who aren't guitar freaks to be interested. But, and I assume that if I talk about what tremolo is or why, who Scotty Moore is and why I use that, or who Tony Hicks is from the Hollies or whatever, that they are, even though they're not guitar nerds, they're interested and smart enough to go, oh, okay, yeah, this is interesting stuff. So I don't get too, and because of that as well, you don't get too techie. You don't want to turn it into a guitar magazine. You want it to be for the man or woman on the tray, or the man or woman having it in their on their coffee table on a Sunday afternoon, you know.
But what does come across is my well-rehearsed excuse for why I buy guitars, which is I will write a new song if I buy a different guitar, which is absolutely true. I remember, to name drop here, being at an event and with David Gilmour, Guy was there, and I just bought an old Les Paul, and you know, I was feeling quite upset about how much money I'd spent on it. And David said, "Yeah, but the thing is, you always write a good new song when you buy a new guitar, no matter what you spend on." And I have, you know, and that really comes across in the book, that as your guitar collection changes and as new guitars come into your hands, songs jump out of them.
Well, we're extremely, extremely fortunate. I know we know that. I've always got this gratitude about that. I think the timing, aside from I had the idea, which, you know, I mentioned about patch photographs, I kind of then got the vision of it. If I get the idea for something, I'm like, this is the way it is with albums as well, or songs, you know, I'm like a dog with a bone. I just do, if I feel like it's a good idea, I don't let up. And I saw the idea for the book in my mind. And then I got the title. I thought Mars Guitars, well, that's a no-brainer. And but to get back to your point, I think it also happened at a time in my life when I'm sort of looking around going, wow, time goes by so quickly, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, look at what I've amassed, and kind of honouring it, really. Do you know, it was a funny thing was, so when I did the autobiography 2016, right, going into it, I thought, well, the one thing that I will get out of this is catharsis, because I keep hearing that's what happens, right, when you do an autobiography. Well, I'm still waiting for it. It didn't happen. And, you know, when I saw Pete, Townsend, he was asking me about that. And he said, well, maybe there isn't any, classic Pete. So, yeah. But he's right. You know, I did that autobiography. There was no catharsis. And it was the first thing everybody asked me when I was being interviewed about it. And, you know, I got lots of other things out of the experience. But doing this book, there was a lot involved in it. Okay, so I've been, I'm very proud to say, I've been involved in every single minute of it, every second of it. Aided and abetted by my mate Matt Bancroft, who's my art director, does the sleeves with me and videos. I couldn't have done it without him. But, you know, all the shooting, arranging the shoots, scheduling it, serial numbers, identifying this, that, and the other, the photography, the layout, blah, blah, blah. So I was involved in all of that. So when we planned the shoots over a couple of weeks, and I would pull out my Epiphone Casino, for example. Now, I hadn't had reason to play that guitar for many, many years. And it happened to be the one I did How Soon Is Now on, and a bunch of others. And when I held it, I was like, whoa, immediately went back to where I was, who I was, why I bought it. I knew how it felt to be me at that time, and the songs I wrote and everything. And then that happened with so many guitars, and I come home in the evening, say to Angie, my wife, I was like, wow, I was really feeling quite, well, emotional, really, because the catharsis happened with this book. And it's, for me, it's an interesting thing that it didn't happen cerebrally or through words, but it happened through holding these guitars and plugging them in. And all the, everything they meant to me, and I'm not just talking about the 80s, stuff in the 90s, in the 2000s, when I was working with Hans and all this stuff. It really, holding those instruments and hearing them and playing them, the feel of the neck, the weight, the strap, all of this stuff, the case, really brought me back to who I was and what I was thinking when I got them, which sometimes is a bit scary, frankly.
But it must just take up so much time, because I've literally just done the thing of getting the books out of the attic and putting them in the new library at home. And I've just did all the music books. And of course, it's impossible, because every book you take out of the box, you open it up.
You look for yourself. 20 pages, 20 you look pages. For yourself in the index.
Well, obviously not. And that takes, so with a guitar, it must be that times a million, you know, once you've got it in your lap.
The thing is with, and I totally get everything you're saying. The thing is with guitars, and, you know, you do say how different makes and brands of guitars give you different expression and give you different ways of approaching songwriting. That's for sure. The thing is, though, the guitarist tends to dominate the guitar, in that you put any guitar in Jeff Beck's hands, in, you know, when he was around, he would sound like Jeff Beck. Put any guitar in Dave Gilmour's hand, he would sound like David Gilmour. Put David Gilmour's guitar in someone else's hand, it won't sound like David Gilmour. So it's that balance between the guitar and you. I mean, I don't know how much what you feel about that.
Well,
that's
entirely true, Gary, because
that conversation.
There's a story that keeps coming up, because the Red 355 that I've got on the cover of this book is quite well known. I'm sort of associated, I think, with...
Is that the one that Seymour Stein bought?
The Seymour Stein one,
yeah. So there's a story that comes up about that, which is, yeah, Seymour got it, me, and then the very first thing I did.
When you did that, were you thinking, you're just thinking like, this is just a classic rock and roll story, isn't it? This is something I've got in the back pocket for life.
Not at the time, I got Seymour Stein
to buy me.
Well, do you know what, Guy? The answer to that is, in all honesty, if I look back now, In the Smiths Every Day was like that.
Yeah.
Really? I wasn't thinking this is a great story because Every Day is a great story, really. Right, you know, I was like, wow. But to come back to what Gary was saying, it's quite interesting because when I've had to tell that story, or when I've told that story, it's a couple of things. It's about, yes, we know that some instruments have songs in them. I mean, it just is. We know we've done it. And that, in that case of the 355, Heaven Knows, I immediately played Heaven, you know, I don't know when you can hear this, but, or whether it's...
Oh.
And it normally goes off the music on Zoom, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is it gone off now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Never mind.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Hold the guitar up. Let's see the guitar.
Well, while playing thing. This, okay, so this is my... Okay, so this is my...
Jaguar.
Signature Jag, right? So my point was that... when, so if I was to play that 355, and I show you those chords, those quite jazzy chords that came out as soon as I started to play, you would go, oh, yeah, I see how the guitar would suggest that. It's a little jazzy and it's a... looks like it's a big guitar and all of that. However, there's parts in that song that are me imposing, doing exactly what you say. I've only realized it because I've had to play it a couple of times in demonstration. There's an arpeggio line at the top, which has no business being on a 355, frankly. So it's a whole load of things that happen in the amazing kind of, you know, the whatever that reaction that happens between a musician and an instrument, you know, to get cosmic about it, that happens when people are just novices as well. It's fantastic. People who are just getting their technique together can impose their style, if you like. It's fantastic. That's why some of those great people who sort of play in a kind of amateurish way, if you like, with some of those garage bands from the 60s or whatever, or some great indie bands, their limitations are what makes them interesting.
Isn't it? There's lots of types of music which have basically come about from someone trying to play a style of music and actually not being able to do it, and in the process inventing another one.
I deliberately got my Rickenbacker as my first backup guitar when I first got my first publishing deal. My first proper, okay, in the Smith, like, this is my main guitar. I deliberately got a Rickenbacker because I knew it would make me play in a certain way.
But what's interesting is the great thing that you say in the book is actually how much of that Smith stuff is a Les Paul. But you're absolutely right that the Rickenbacker became fixed in one's head. And so, oh, it's jangly, Johnny. No, I know this is something you hated.
Mm-hmm. I think because that was because the Birds kind of connection.
Yeah, you know. But you're right. It's absolutely a perception. You can easily go back and listen to that and go, well, yeah.
So the obvious question is, Johnny, what is the guitar that you found Johnny Marr on? When did you actually think, now is the moment, I know I'm not copying anyone else, I am me, and this has made it happen?
I'd say there's been two major moments for that. It sounds a bit grandiose, but without a doubt, one was the Rickenbacker, and then I had exactly the same kind of experience, in fact, more so in 2005 when I picked up Isaac Brock's Jaguar. Because by then, I knew what I really worked myself out, and I'd had it projected at me. I've been very, very fortunate to have it projected at me from fans and the press. And more importantly, when I've gone to sessions and people wanted me to do play a certain way, I know how I'm supposed to sound, right?
You're your own AI.
Yeah. And the Jag. So that moment I talk about in the book where, you know, it's whatever, late at night in Portland, Oregon, and I'm jet lagged and playing with Isaac. First time we'd met, he's got to do a bit of performance art. Just me and him. He's got a jug of wine on the floor. I've never seen a jug of wine before. And it's half empty, by the way. You know, I thought, what's this, 1936 in, you know, Louisiana or something? And he's got like a scheme. He's got a goggles on and a weird flying hat. And
you're pretending that's normal.
Yeah. Well, people who know Isaac just do that every day. It's amazing. Right, brilliant to be around. But it was a surreal moment. And my Fender Telecaster wasn't competing with his. I don't know whether you ever seen those Super 6 amps, those Fender Super 6s.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, talk about monsters. So I picked up his Jag, and when I started playing it, I knew that something very important was happening in my life. Normal, regular, well-balanced people will go, that's a bit over the top. But because it's my, well, I was right. Because, 17 years later, I played nothing else on stage other than the Jags, and now, and it's got my name on, and Fender just keeps making them and making them because it's
I've always been worried about the vulnerability of those buttons, you know.
Yeah, but that's the first thing I changed, Gary. Due diligence, mate.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So had you literally not picked up a Jaguar before that?
I had one, and I didn't really get along with it. And I'd done that thing like, you know, file under, not me. And it just was, it was the only one that of his that wasn't, that I didn't need a tetanus to play, right? And, and so I picked that up. And, but actually, so what I'm, Gary, was I fell in love with that 63 Jag. Absolutely thought it was perfection. But then as I played it day in, day out, I started to notice what I call unwanted conditions. And one of those was the switches that switch on and off, which is why the grunge bands say used to put gaffer tape over those things to stop them switching off. You know why why those kill, this could switch people off, but why those kill switches actually exist on guitars? I think it's a great, great story. It's mostly because in the 50s and 60s, when musicians were doing radio dates with orchestras on the radio, quite often those radio stations were near power lines and near trains, like in Chicago and New York, and you would get insane RF interference. And if you were if you weren't coming in until bar 156, you needed to kill the guitar before you came in. So bar 155, you switch the thing on.
Yeah.
Of course, in this day and age, for the last 50 years, 40 years, that's been completely unnecessary. So I got rid of that, and I changed out once I started to break through and just make some changes on the Jag. It took me, believe it or not, it was 2 years working on it. And I was touring all that time, and I was changing these prototypes and changing the pickups and all of this stuff.
Was this were you in relationship with Fender then? Were they doing that with you?
To be honest, Fender very kindly left me to it because my friend Bill Puplet, who's in Harrow and Weald, he's been working with me on my guitar since the 80s, and he's done stuff with Jimmy Page, and he's done John Paul Jones and all kinds of stuff. Bill's been around since the 60s, and he is a genius. So I said to Fender, look, lead me to it. And if I need some help with a neck or whatever, let me build this Jag and get obsessive about it. And then I'll deliver you what I think is the perfect Jaguar for me. And they've been absolutely true to the word. You know, every single one in any shop in Sydney or in the, you know, in wherever is exactly the same as mine. The dimensions and everything about it is the same as mine. And I'm very, very proud of it. But that definitely was, that Jag makes me play really like me. You know, it's not just a vanity project. And in fact, what it was when we finished it, Bill, who works with me on it, as I say, he's quite a sort of fairly laid back guy. And I was playing high volume, he said, oh, because it sounds like a Ricky, plays like a Fender, and it sounds like a Gretsch too. So a Ricky and a Gretsch plays like a Fender, which is a good assessment, really, of my kind of my sound. It would have saved me an awful lot of money back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would have had a much thinner book, though.
What I like about But I also like about the book is just your journey into guitars and the inspiration other guitar players have had in your life. And the fact that Bolan was your first love, and it was my first love too.
Yeah.
And that, so the Les Paul was obviously what he was famous for.
Yeah.
But I thought for years that he had a gold top, but it, in the same way that I thought Mick Ronson had a gold top, but neither of them had gold top Les Pauls. They'd, both of them had cleaned all the paint off the front of standards, or one, actually one was a custom, which was Mick's, and Mark's was a custom, and he took the paint off of, made it look gold. But what was confusing about Mark's is he had a custom neck. This is geeky, I know
that,
I hope
yeah.
people don't turn off. That it was this amazing bastard guitar.
You know, yeah.
But it just, as a kid, it was the B-side of, I think it was Hot Love, was the B-side was Life's a Gas, and they had a little, it was taken up by a whole picture of him and Mickey and a
that was Jeepster. That was the first single I ever bought. No, you're right. I could talk about guitar all day, and I think I probably have, sir, and all night, several times. That was like the Holy Grail, because what you've demonstrated there is this, you know, obsession and fascination and detail. And people are like that about motorbikes and about cars. And so why should guitar players be any different? But those nuance and that obsession and attention to detail and fascination, I hope has come out in the book and in the interview I did with Martin Kelly, because Martin, as we know, you know, he's an expert on all things modern guitars or the last guitar culture. So as well as him being my mate, I thought he'd be exactly the right guy to pull stuff out of me. You know, another really satisfying thing that happened during the making of the book. So I didn't realize all this text and stories and just all of that life story stuff was actually going to come out. I just hadn't thought of that. It was about making these beautiful photographs. And then in the process of it, these things came out. But it's been nice thinking about some of the guitar players and kind of honoring some of the guitar players who influenced me and have influenced us, I'd say, who don't usually, you know, go under the radar a little bit. People like Chris Bedding and Bill Nelson.
Yeah.
Tony Hicks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was great to read about Bill Nelson when because you clocked he was playing an SG, the Yamaha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
which I could never see you with, by the way. Could never, ever see
you. Well, funny enough you say that, because Steve Norman, on our first album, in fact, our first two albums where Steve Norman played the electric guitar before he moved on to playing saxophone, he played a Yamaha SG. It was the guitar of the moment, and it was because of Bill Nelson.
Yeah, well, there's all that nuance, because the bottom line with those, with like McGeoch was like the man for me, and Bill Nelson, those guys could already play. This is the thing that guitar players know, but they couldn't not play when the Pistols formed, and then suddenly they could play like demons. What were they doing before that? Well, all of them were playing Sunshine of Your Love and All Right Now, right? And some of them were stretching out and doing, you know, advanced stuff, but they were really good players. And the politics and fashion of guitar culture dictated that, well, the Les Paul was, you know, let's say rockist, other than in Steve Jones's hands, but you wanted a great instrument. So that Yamaha SG was really a beautiful instrument. So it ticked quite a lot of boxes.
Probably quite cheap as well, weren't they? Japanese guitars were still cheaper then.
Well, I mean, I disliked them intensely at the time, but as years have gone on, it is handy that they're quite cheap, but they're amazing instruments. And they sound like you go for that. It's, again, we come back to that associative thing. You put it on and you just want to do the Banshees, or you want to do Bill Nelson's Red Noise, or, you know, whatever it might be. You have this associative thing. I mean, a more pertinent example for people might be like the Gibson 295, the big gold Gibson Scotty Moore. When people pick that up, I mean, it's a real diverse guitar, but you end up just trying to play rockabilly on it. Everyone wants, you know, you end up trying to play that.
But there was that move. There was that move into 50s kind of, because 50s culture had come back at the beginning of the 80s. Everyone, you know, there was people like Bow Wow Wow were playing them. And
correct.
Well, punk was 50s.
Billy Duffy.
Was 50s, you know. Yeah.
Billy Duffy, you know, I mean, that's why we wanted it, wasn't it? You wanted that twangier sound.
Well, the start of the book, actually, it starts off with me in my bedroom with this Les Paul standard that I got, which that in itself has got a story, because it came back to me only a few years ago, which is amazing. I never ever thought I'd lay eyes on that again. But then the next one is that when I formed the Smiths, because of this thing we're talking about, this 50s culture, remember it was 82. And the cool thing was, you know, Matthew Ashman, he was great in Bow Wow Wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's playing he's playing a Falcon and Theatre of Hay, and it's all in the air. And, you know, Edwin is up, he's playing. And Edwin's
the Quiff is back.
Yeah, well, and Edwin's, I was a little more on my vibe in that. I was sort of doing the King's Road thing as I was walking around, you know, as a person. But I also loved the Velvets. So Edwin's got the Gretsch, really. He's thinking Lou Reed, you know. So Gretsch's are back and Les Paul's are out, and Strats are definitely out for, you know, in alternative music, and et cetera. All these politics are all very, very important when you're young. But
yeah, oh yeah.
Luckily for me, the book sort of starts with me trading in the Les Paul for the Gretsch when I formed the Smiths. But because I couldn't afford a Falcon.
Yeah, it's not a Gretschy Gretsch.
I ended up getting this, what's called a Super Axe, and it strangely cut sort of space age, and it had an amazing sound because it had a built-in compressor, and it's there's no one else.
Oh yeah, well, I was going to ask about that. Actually, Townsend played one of those for briefly, because Who's Next is a Gretsch. It's a country gentleman.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, is it a 6120?
6120. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Which.
Or was it 6135?
No, I think it's 6120.
But Johnny, just tell that story how that guitar came back to you.
Yeah, because also I want to know about the effects.
Well, the effects. Well, there's a phaser which is just really stupid. You know, just sounds like some like 70s Jerry and Sylvia Anderson soundtrack. I traded it in 82, just before I formed the Smiths, as part of the whole new chapter. Guys holding it up there, and that Les Paul. And then a friend of mine who's a guitar geek found it in a record shop, this up north somewhere, up in the wilds or in Yorkshire. 2017, man.
And they knew it was yours in the shop?
No, he knew it was mine because he's been working with me for years. Yeah, because I changed the tuners, and there's a little hole where I moved the pick guard, and he'd identified it. And that was beautiful.
I've just had a similar event in that the black Stratocaster that I played on stage at Live Aid went missing, strangely enough, in the 90s. And which, you know, I was a bit sad about. A few months ago, it appeared in a shop up in near Nottingham. And I've just bought it back for myself.
Oh, congratulations. That's amazing that you were able to get it.
Well, someone saw it and photographed it and sent me the photograph, and I said, he said, "Is this your guitar?" It was.
I mean, the chances of that. I mean, I've got a few of those stories in the book that, again, when I started the original idea for the book, which was, you know, riding around on a tour bus about 5 years ago, I didn't realize that all of this stuff was going to come out. And now that it's out, it's a little bit bemusing, really. When a guitar was stolen off the stage of the Scala in 2000 and, was it 2001? From a fan or a guy got up out of the audience when the band were breaking the gear down and just took my main guitar, my SG, the one that I just was going nuts about. Wow. And just walked out the front door with it. But the amazing thing is that, and that was a whole episode in itself. And the next day I went round to Bert Janci's for some solace. And Bert listened to me very sagely and listened to my tale of woe. I was quite upset. And then he said to me, have you never had a guitar stolen? And I was like, oh, thanks, Bert. but 10 years later, I was in Toronto playing with the Cribs, and my manager called me and said, hey, there's a detective who's been assigned to work in King's Cross, and he's taken it upon himself. He's called and he's a fan, and he's just gone, that guitar car have just disappeared. And so I had to fill out another crime report, thought nothing of it.
Hang on, I could see a box set. I'm going to go and write a box set after this.
It came back.
it's amazing.
The guy found it. The detective found it. And the guy who'd stolen it still had it. I mean, it'd been broken.
Meanwhile, there's 9 unsolved murders.
yeah. But this is beautiful because Frampton lost his guitar, didn't he, for quite a long time.
That's the most extraordinary story of
what,
all.
What was that? Remind me.
Stories.
I can't remember.
It was it basically went down in a plane crash in the jungle in Central America somewhere, and then was clearly gone. And then somehow, I don't know, through it turned up 40 years later.
That is amazing. Well, Rory Gallagher's famous Strat, Rory Gallagher's famous, very famous.
The first knackered guitar we ever saw. Is it the first? I remember the first time you ever saw a guitar that wasn't kind of pristine.
Well, because he played every since being, I think he was 11 when he got it, and he played for years with it, ate and slept and with that guitar. But also
and drank,
in the late 60s, it was stolen and it went missing for 3 weeks, and it was on a crime show in Ireland on the television. And whoever had stolen it, obviously lost the nerve. But anyway, it was found in a ditch, and he got it back. And that was years ago. I mean, that was when he was a young man. That's like
the FA Cup.
Yeah.
The dog sniffed it out. I remember my dad bought a fur coat. Well, it was a fake fur coat from the local pub where we lived. And he gave it to my mum, and he was very happy he'd done that. And that weekend, it was on Police 5. So he hid it under the floorboards of our house.
Because you're doing a thing. I heard you on Radio 4 the other day, or you're doing a thing on Great Sporting Crimes.
Yeah.
You should be doing guitar, great stolen guitars.
I should, yeah. That was a voiceover thing I did. I thought... Gary, you might appreciate this. The listeners are going to have to use their imagination. Okay.
Oh, my God. The Hagstrom. The Hagstrom. It's the Roxy Music for your pleasure, isn't it? Yeah. Brian Ferry's holding it in the gatefold sleeve. I mean, I am so... It's probably the guitar I'm the most jealous of that you own. It's lost its blue patina from the original photograph, isn't it?
It has. And also, I think the photograph was probably touched up a little, so I think it was extremely blue, but it has. But Brian gave me that for Will Sargent's very jealous as well that I've got that. And
my God.
I think pretty much everyone in the world is very jealous that you've got that, Johnny, frankly.
And that's one of Nile Rodgers's.
Oh,
Jesus. With the mirror plate, scratch plate.
He gave me that in New York.
Wow, it looks like it's been used. Did he play any particular tracks with that, do you know?
I don't know, but...
let's say it's Good Times, right?
It's not the hit maker, but it's what...
It's not the hit maker.
Oh, because he's got the hit maker, isn't he? But Johnny, that's... Sorry, go on, grab that. What was that you were going to grab?
This is a bit of a treasure. This is Bert Jante's...
Oh, my God.
Yamaha. Martin. Oh, it's Yamaha. It's
Yamaha.
Oh, there it goes. Zoom just cut it out.
It's so weird how it detects music.
But let's just talk about that, because this is something that's really interesting about you as a guitar player. Your sort of three favourite guitarists, Bert Jansch, you know, acoustic folky, you know, James Williamson, you know, Iggy Pop fills every bit of the space with his noise. And then Nile Rodgers.
Mm.
You can't get three more diverse guitarists, but they made you, didn't they?
They did. It all makes sense to me. And actually, I understand and I've had to think about the eccentricity of that, or how unusual that is. But actually, it makes perfect sense, because those guys have got it, aside from John McLaughlin, those guys have got it all covered. Because, you know, the thing with James Williamson and Raw Power, it's like the cover. It's like Iggy on the cover. It's so attitude-y. It's so catchy. It's dangerous. But it's also got a fair amount of technique. You know, I always describe him as having, you know, all the attitude of Keith Richards and all the technique of, all the attitude of Keith Richards and the technique of Jimmy Page, you know. And so both those things together are a pretty lethal combination. And then Bert's arpeggio, but Bert wasn't as precise as people might imagine. And he played really quite, Bernard Butler used to say, violently on the acoustic, whereas Nick Drake was incredibly precise. Nick Drake took what Bert was doing and really was precise.
Yeah.
Bert was very, very loose, but that arpeggio thing where you're able to play, so the guitar sounds like three things at once, so that's covered. So you've got the kind of cool attitude of James, and then you've got the facility of, and being at a place so it sounds like three guitars of Bert. And then you've got, for me with Nile, it's all about the left hand. You know, I mean, I've said this a couple of times, but people fixate with Nile Rodgers, quite understandably, with his rhythm playing. It's so identifiable.
Yeah, right.
But it's what he was doing. It's those beautiful McCoy Tyner-like chord changes. I would say with Nile, it's you hear his, you hear his heart in his left hand, you hear his soul in the right hand.
What's interesting, you saying that about those three players, is it's very easy to come to later in life and say that's all right and decide what you are. But going back, and I was listening to some early stuff this morning, and you're absolutely right in that it was all there right from the word go. I mean, This Night Has Opened My Eyes, for instance, is pure Nile, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was always there.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where it's a bit chicken and egg, because I was drawn to that because it kind of spoke to me. Those chord changes really, it spoke to me. And I think that's the thing with inspiration. I think you have to be connected to it for it to make such an impact on you in the first place. It can't just be like, oh, I've heard this person and now I'm dazzled by it. I think it has to speak to something that where you want to go, you know. So I had that, again, to come back to James Williamson, with there's a song on Raw Power called Gimme Danger. And I was already, the reason I've discovered that was because my mate, it was Billy Duffy, said, I was writing a song and he said, oh, it sounds like Gimme Danger. And I was like, what's that? But I was already going down that road. So with Burr and with Nile and with James, it was like those guys were like these older brothers I didn't know who were shining a light along this path and saying, there you go. That's how it felt. I had to try to learn how to do it.
Was it nerve-wracking playing with Burr himself, you know, because he was so proficient?
Yeah, it was. But it's beautiful. It was exactly... Every time, well, not every time we played, because we played on stage a couple of times, a few times, but when Bert and I used to play, it was in his front room, and we'd start off improvising, and 2 hours would go by without stopping. There's a photograph in the book of us doing that. And that's, when I was a kid, what I thought him and John Renbord would be doing. And the stuff of, there was only a couple of players that I actually, with a record player and played along regularly with. I used to work out some songs because me and my band wanted to do, you know, do anything you want to do, or we wanted to do an only one song or whatever it was. I used to work out the track, but sit and be taken away for a few hours by someone. There was only really, really Burr who did that for me.
Because the hard thing is knowing if he's got some alternative tuning. You had to work that out too, didn't you?
Yeah, well then, you know, the accidental mistakes that happen come into play then. But why I mentioned that was that when we started playing regularly, Bert and I, he made a point of saying that he was, you know, I could follow him or anticipate what he was doing. It came down to playing along with those records and learning that bit of his playing, you know. It was amazing. It was a little like an automatic rewind to the 14-year-old me and what I kind of was imagining he was doing, you know.
Folk music guy. Yeah. See, folk music is yeah, we had David Johnson on and we were talking about, you know, that great folk revival that happened in the 70s.
Who was it? Was the guy, the banjo player from the Dubliners was, I can't remember the name. Hmm. Yeah, no banjo ever turned your head, John.
well, Modest Mouse they kind of pioneered the neo-banjo that came, you know, came back in the, I don't know how I feel about that. You never heard me.
Alt banjo. Yeah.
for people who don't know, Johnny, I think you should just tell us about the Noel Gallagher gift. And because, I mean, the guy was mentioning earlier how generous you are, but starting Noel off and inspiring him. And, you know, what you do and what you've done many times is pass the baton, but literally the guitar.
Well,
I think lend someone a guitar and they change the pickups, isn't it?
No. So look, the thing with that, I mean, it's been told so many different ways. And my brother, I won't go into all the details, but my brother introduced me to Noel because he knew Noel and he thought that Noel's was pretty cool. And my brother's a very discerning guy. He's got good taste. And for him to say, well, you want to check this guy out, means a lot. So Noel and I met and we have a cup of tea and I just liked him. I mean, no one knew, you know, could anticipate that he was going to be, you know, a worldwide rock superstar. Well, actually, he probably could. But fair enough. But he was a young guy and I liked him and we had a lot in common. funny enough. I mean, all right, he was a young guy on the dole, but he was, I don't know, he's Mancunian Irish and, you know.
Are you a red, though? You're a red, aren't you, Johnny?
No, I'm a big blue. Big blue.
Oh, are you? We beat you last week at the other weekend.
Yeah, okay, okay. Enjoy it.
It's going well. It's all going so well.
I know.
Sorry.
But so anyway, I liked him just on a human level. I thought he was a good guy, but I could see he was on a mission. And anyway, I went to see Oasis, and they, you know, everyone says this kind of thing, but honestly, it was 14 people and a dog. They were on at 7 o'clock. I think they were on third on the bill to Molly Halfhead. Were headlining. Do you remember them?
No.
Molly Hatchet.
So they were on at 7 o'clock. It was still light outside. I went to see them, 14 people, and they were all their mates and girlfriends and stuff. And then we were speaking on the phone, and he asked me what I thought. And I said, well, you know, brilliant. Yeah, great. But you take such a long time tuning up in between numbers. And he had one of those, what they call stroboscope.
The strobo tuner, yeah, the con strobo. Yeah.
Which was his pride and joy, and he had his Epiphone. And in between numbers, he would tune up, and it was taking him a long time to tune, and I just pointed that out. I said, well, the one thing I think would be better is if you hurry up in between songs and you need a backup guitar. And he said, well, it's all right. Quite rightly, he said to me, well, that's all right for you to say. You know, I'm on the dole living in India House, and you're Johnny Marr, whatever. And I went, yeah, good point. So then he went in the studio. I sent a few guitars his way to use on the session. And I was like, he's going to love this Les Paul. I thought I couldn't give him something crappy. This stuff wasn't cool. And I was able to do it. So I sent off the Les Paul, and then he started writing on it. And to be fair, I immediately gave it him. It wasn't like, does this, you know, this thing's crept into the story that like I loaned Noel the guitar
this,
and
this wasn't,
he didn't give it me back. I gave
this
it
This wasn't
him.
A bad, this is a no. really, I mean, I would imagine that held a good price anyway, before it was even Johnny Marr's or Noel Gallagher's. This is a 58 or something? No, Les Paul?
It's a 1960 Les Paul that I got from the 60. Who. So it was one that I got off John Entwistle. And I'd done Panic on it. I'd done London. I'd done a whole load of Smith stuff on it. But I was really happy for him. I had a load of them, you know, and as I said, I just couldn't give him something crappy. So he wrote Slide Away on it, and then next thing, he started playing that as his main guitar. So it was his main guitar, so I just said, you can have it. But the funny bit is that some people might already know this, but a few months later, by this time, Oasis were on my management. I got a call from someone in the office one morning and said, oh, hey, Johnny, listen, got a bit of a problem. Oasis got into a fight on stage last night, and it wasn't with each other, it was with the audience in Newcastle. And I was like, yes, what about it? And he said, well, the Les Paul's got damaged. And I thought she was phoning to say, I apologize for that. But she said, you haven't got another one, have you? So, so I ran into the studio, and I thought, well, I mean, they had a gig, you know, they had gigs. So I thought, well, I can't replace it with something crappy. So I gave him my 73 Les Paul. I absolutely didn't mind. You know, he was my mate, and he was in a place, and he used it. What was great, though, is that at that time, it's amazing the way life turns out, isn't it, sometimes? But I wouldn't have foresaw that 20 years later I would be doing an overdub on an Oasis album, and I was stood listening, just at deafening volume, stood at the mixing desk, hearing it for the first time. And Noel's tech, who'd been my tech, just passes me the Les Paul that I'd given him 20 years earlier. That was a nice bit of a closure, I think. Yeah, so it's gone to a great home, and I'm really pleased that that Noel's got right at the 11th hour doing the book. So many really nice little prizes happening in the making of this book. But right at the 11th hour, he texted me and he said, oh, listen, do you remember that Strat I got from you? I've just remembered that's the Wonderwall guitar, and Don't Look Back in Anger. Do you want me to send it up for the book? So I said, sure. I'm waiting for him to say I can have it, but
he's not as generous as you.
Yeah. No. Do you know what? He's given me a really cool acoustic.
I wanted to mention
you and Hank Marvin should go and commiserate about guitars. Bruce Welch has got the red strap, which is actually Cliff's.
Oh, I don't mind all of that stuff. I love that Bernard Butler's got the Smith 335, because he's got loads of use. I just love that he's got it. It's great, you know.
And he's very nice in the book. He writes a lovely piece in the book. Oh, he's really just, you know. Also, it's still yours. Yeah.
He said a lovely thing, but because I put your book up on Instagram when you sent it to me, and I actually said I was quite pleased. I said this guitar porn seems too vulgar a term. This is more like high-end Luthiesque erotic literature. and Bernard wrote a really lovely comment underneath. He said, "Yeah, it's almost like I'd be more worried about the book than the guitar."
I just want to mention a great luthier that you talk about, which is Roger Giffin. Because I was
on that page, Gary. Look,
I played Giffin in the 80s, actually, late 80s. I've still got my Giffin. It was a great guitar.
Was it like a Telecaster shape?
It's a Stratocaster shape. Red.
Okay, yeah.
I'll send you a picture.
Yeah, he's now in Portland, Oregon, which is my old kind of stomping ground. You know, it's a small world. You know, people's paths cross. Again, I hadn't thought about how, you know, in those early years in the 80s, I would go into New Kings Road Guitars. Now it's New Kings Road Guitars, and it was Earl's Court Guitars at one time. And I would bump into people, you know, and everyone, you know, it was like, it was dead cool. It wasn't necessarily, you know, just super famous people, but it was really nice to, you know, meet Gary Moore, you know, he was really sweet. As I say, it's a small world. We all know someone who knows someone.
But talk about this Giffin guitar. This is not where we were talking about perception and looks of things. I remember because this was quite, you used this a lot, right? Early 80s. Knew that.
That green Telecaster,
But again, it's just a percent. That's quite a Muso-y looking guitar for you, don't you think, for the time? The fact that it's green and...
Well, the fact that it's green...
The humbucker and everything.
I think, but I think you would have had to... You would know that because you've sort of a bit more nuanced. But I think people who were following me, say like, you know, a kid starting out in Dundee who was a big Smiths fan... just would have seen this really dazzling, unusual guitar. Yeah. They wouldn't have thought...
Emerald.
They wouldn't have thought that looks like a PRS or anything. They just went... Because because I used it when the band were blowing up, I get asked about that guitar as much as any other guitar, really. The green Tele. And I was determined, again, to get back to the abstract thing, I really was determined to have a full page that is just the back green.
It is amazing.
Beautiful shot.
I mean, that you're right. I mean, that could be a picture of the Amazon rainforest.
That's right.
From a plane, couldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
From a satellite. Yeah. No, it's absolutely. What about amps, Johnny? Did you have the same collecting bug over amplifiers?
Yeah, I did, but
space.
I did.
A lot more room.
That's right. Well, no, I think I'm a bit more pragmatic.
Fender's your thing, right? Fender.
Yeah, but you know, the answer is yes, because I've got to have a really good AC30, you know, but you just got to, you know, and if you're blessed enough to be in the situation to get one. And also, they just weren't that as expensive, all of this stuff in the 80s. Yeah, you know, I mean, we are very privileged, but you could pick that stuff up, as we all know. I mean, I've always said this, like vintage guitars weren't called vintage guitars, they were just old guitars.
That's right.
Yeah. And they become, in a way, they became popularized, like a lot of things, like leather jackets or quiff haircuts or bike boots or, the 80s did...
Fetishized.
Did this thing, reappropriated, post-modern, all of these things.
Well, there was a thing, isn't there, that Alan Rogan... our beloved Alan Rogan and...
Pete Townsend's old tech.
You know, and Phil Taylor... you know, David Gilmour's tech between them, but kind of invented this thing of the vintage guitar.
This I find interesting. This blew my mind a little bit. So the great, late, great Alan Rogan, who we all know, I talk about him in the book, you know, he's a good friend of ours, mine, and he started working for The Who, I think in 75, maybe 74. And he first started working for John. And when he and John used to come back from America and say, look, I've got two orange 6120s. At that time, it was the same as people saying, I've got two Macintosh laptops. You're like, why do you need two? Mm-hmm. Because back then, the vibe, if you think of Kossoff or Ronson or Rory Gallagher, the 70s pre-punk guitar players, the whole vibe was that you were faithful to that one instrument and you had a backup if you had a string break. The idea that why would you have five of the same ones? And it was because of Alan's, he grew up, little boy in Newcastle, literally face up against the window of the guitar shops. And he and Entwistle going around America on those Who tours, doing that thing Ian Hunter talks about in Diary of Rock and Roll Store, start buying these in these cheap guitar pawn shops, buying these guitars really cheap. And they were literally bringing them back to London and everyone was going, well, yeah, but why do you need three 335s? Why do you need that?
Well, Townsend made a virtue out of it, didn't he? Stuck numbers on all of the those Les Pauls.
Well, that's for tuning.
Yes, but there was a sense of like, here, look, I've got more than one. You know.
Well, funny enough, you know, as kids, you know, in our lives growing up, we all have a moments for that when we stayed up too late and saw a horror film and it stuck in our psyche for years. Pete doing that took me a long time to get over. When I first saw that, I had very mixed feelings about that because very, very mixed feelings about it because I was a maybe 13-year-old boy living in the provinces who just, the idea of owning one was unimaginable. So seeing someone with 11 was pretty weird, but I played one of them about, it might have even been 11, last year with Pearl Jam at Hyde Park. And wow. do you think I was happy to be playing it? Shit, yeah, of course I was.
I love that.
Well, Ron, can I just tell you a sweet Alan Rogan story, by the way, while we're on him?
Sure,
Johnny.
Of course.
Which was when I went to Alan's memorial, and on the program of events, on the back, it had the Alan Rogan joke, which is the famous joke, which is what do Keith Richards, Pete Townsend, and Eric Clapton all have in common? They all worked for Alan Rogan. And Kerry, Alan's daughter, told me, I said, oh, it was great you got the joke. She said, I got it from Rock on Tours. I got it from when Johnny was on Rock on Tours.
Oh.
We told the joke. She hadn't heard it before. And that ended up at, so that's...
He's an important guy. Yeah, very, very. Yeah. We've all got the Alan Rogan stories. But this book wouldn't have happened, certainly in the way it has, without him. We know that.
We should plug your new album. You got a Greatest Hits album come out, right? Right.
I have.
Yes, 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
Tell us. Go on.
Well, that came about because my manager about 18 months ago said to me, "Do not go back in the studio and do a new record." And I was a little, excuse me. We'll see about that. That's what I do, you know. But he knows me, and he knows that's what I was revving up to do. And he said, "No. You know, it will have been 10 years." Since the first solo record, and you should mark it. It should be a demarcation, and you put out whatever 14, 15 singles. And some of them done really well on the radio and everything, and, you know, do it as a sort of celebration and everything. So I think he was right, because when we put it together, and I had to really, it was only when I had to listen to the, because I still listen to the test pressings. I do, again, you know.
Oh,
I did my due diligence. Well, so I sat very late at night listening out for the pops and crackles and all that. And because I was listening to it so objectively, as each track came along, because I changed the, it's not in, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not in the chronological order. I put it together in a different way. I found it to be a really good listen because I was genuinely listening to it with some objectivity. I know it might sound a little disingenuous or whatever, but so I texted the band and said, hey, listen, you know, we've made a really good record here, you know, congratulations and everything. So because of that moment, I feel good about it. I'm like, oh, you know, it's a good listen. Mm-hmm. It's a double album and there's been, you know, there's quite a lot of bangers on there. So that's pretty good.
I was listening to it the other day, Johnny. I thought it sounded great.
Oh, thanks, Gary. Nice one. I'm too close to it, really.
So what's next?
Brilliant.
Well, I'm packing to go to New York in a couple of days. So after I speak to you guys, I've got to run around packing, I do a bit of practicing, and then I've got to, after promoting the book, I'm doing two nights at this new, beautiful, purpose-built theatre, arts kind of theatre in Manchester in December with the orchestra. I've assembled a Johnny Marr orchestra. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm doing two nights of my stuff, you know, coincide with the best of and everything.
Where did you say?
It's called the Aviva Studio. It's a little like the Mancunian Barbican, really, in a way. It's that kind of place.
Whereabouts in December? Is it beginning or the end?
It's 7th and 8th.
I'd love to go up. Wouldn't you like to go up, Guy?
Oh, I'll come up and bring Stan.
I'm trying to see if my diary fits. By the way, as I said, Johnny, you seeing the Stones in New York?
No.
That's not why you're going. They're playing. They're doing a show on Thursday night, I heard.
No, I'm doing when is it? One night next weekend or something. I'm doing an evening where I get up and we'll talk about the guitar book and do a little bit of playing, demonstrating,
fantastic,
that kind of thing.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
Thanks for coming on, Johnny.
Yeah, thanks so much. By the way, Johnny, what I've got to do now, when we finish this, get in the car, drive down to Somerset, and I've got a week's rehearsal for a cancer charity gig with David Palmer.
No way.
Yeah, first time we played together for 30 years.
That's so nice to hear. He's killing it. He's still playing. He's amazing.
Still playing. Rob,
but he's great. Yeah, he's a lifer, isn't he? Same as you guys. Nice one.
And Andy Taylor, right, Guy?
And Andy Taylor, yeah, and Robert Plant's going to be doing it. It's going to be great.
Oh, brilliant. That sounds fun. Well, what are you doing, Gary? What's happening?
I'm doing my new album, actually. I'm in the studio. As it's my birthday today, and my celebration is go back into the studio. You've got a big one coming up as well. We're both October boys.
Yeah. So are you Scorpio?
Libra.
You're Libra. Okay. Yeah, mate. Yeah, that makes more sense.
You got a big one, though, weren't you? You're going to have a party?
I'm doing promotion.
That's old school. I like that.
Yeah. Seriously.
But listen, it was fantastic. And we cannot rave about this book enough. And a shout out to you. Lucky you had, I would say, obviously I'm biased, the finest literary agent there is, Elizabeth Scheinkman.
Elizabeth was really helpful. Yeah, again, another person that I couldn't have done it without. But a few people around me, good people around me, who've made this book happen. And as I say, I'm still genuinely a little bit bemused. I sort of feel. It gets like this with projects sometimes, like albums and tours. You feel like you're sort of coming out into the light, blinking. You know what I mean? And then so getting the love for it is fantastic. But so it's been a mission. Thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me on to talk about it. Really glad you got it. Good luck with the album, yeah. Gary. Have fun.
What a gent. Every time.
Oh, no. I'm sitting here like you know that green guitar? Same colour as my face. what's a boy to do?
On his birthday.
Well, thing is, I've been given a lot of postal orders today for as gifts. So I'm going to try and gather them up with my Green Shield stamps that I've got.
Yeah, go to Woolworths.
Do you know the first...
Actually, that's what I... The one thing we didn't get to say, by the way, I've got to say, is the title of Johnny's book, right? If ever there was a shop that needed to happen,
Mars Guitars.
Do you know
it's funny because he says he bought his parents bought him their first guitar in a shop that sold like brooms and things and buckets and spades. My first guitar that my dad bought me came from a shop that sold electric stuff like radiograms and things like that. It was like, and a couple of guitars. It's so funny those days. They weren't.
That's right. Yeah, that's what. Yeah, it used to be old. And there were those really kind of. I remember Martin Glover had when we were at school. He had one of those really funny looking guitars, which had loads of switches on them.
Yeah.
And cost sort of £8. Yeah. Futurama sort of.
Well, that Hagstrom, don't get me started. I'm so jealous he's got that. The Roxy music.
It's a fine home.
It really is. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Ian for producing today's episode of Rock on Tours. And we will be back, won't we, Guy, next week?
We will be. We better be.
It's good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.